I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is John Bush, co-founder of Athena Health, a cloud-based software-enabled healthcare company that helps manage patients' electronic medical records, enhance communication between patients and physicians, and facilitate payments to healthcare providers. John founded the company in 1997 with Todd Park, whom he worked with at Booz Allen Hamilton. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jessica.
What does Athena Health do?
Athena Health does the healthcare internet. Athena Health has figured out a series of business models that make a basic trade with doctors. I will do your crap work for you that you hate and stink at for less than it costs you to do it. I will lose less of it. And all you have to do is use my backbone instead of whatever software or paper that you have in your office right now. It's a basic trade. It's like the airlines being asked to use the Sabre system in the 70s. And little by little by little, we're doing that.
Why hasn't there been much innovation in the healthcare industry?
Well, I love places where there are no sexy people because I am dying to be seen as the sexy person and have since I was a, you know, child. So the less sexiness, the better, as far as I'm concerned. The real reasons why healthcare doesn't have entrepreneurship is that it's largely illegal. The basic things that monetize business ventures are illegal in healthcare. There are laws against, for example, person A brings business to person B. Person B can't pay person A a commission the way you can in financial services or auto or bank cards or travel or, you know, think of all the things that Google, you know, monetizes by saying, hey, I'll bring you somebody who wants to see a XYZ, click and, you know, give me $4 and I'll serve them up to your server. And the last reason is a good reason, which is that, you know, we have a Hippocratic Oath here. You have to be careful. And when you're careful, you have to go a little slower. And when you could do porn or gaming or social or all the other things that have exploded over the last 20 years online, and if they blow up, who cares? You know, it makes sense that they go first. It makes sense that maybe financial services goes next. And, you know, I'm okay with the idea that healthcare go next as long as it goes. Please, God, let it go.
Can you provide an example of the innovation that you're providing? We're talking at 30,000 feet. But
sure.
For me, for instance, I went to the dentist and I have a cavity and I got x-rays and I'm moving to another dentist and I don't want to get x-rays again.
Boom. Right. So hopefully both your dentists are on AthenaNet and everything that's ever happened in the one dentist is now visible at the other dentist. There's not a copy of it, as the government mandates. There's not a stuff in an envelope. They're just looking with link at the same stuff. As soon as you give permission, that should be allowed to happen.
When you're convincing insurance companies or doctors to adopt Athena Health, how are you getting them to transfer all the paperwork?
Right. That's one of the great early, you know, well, how do I start? How do I get going on this? I get it once I'm on. And we have bumped our nose on steps that don't work. And we've found a path that works. And so we started with the life cycle of the claim. Doctors don't care about the claims that happened last month as soon as they're paid, right? The codes that they use don't mean anything except to the insurance company. It's a big game of kabuki, ritualistic, you know, dueling, and nobody cares. And so you can step in and say, look, starting on this date, I'll send out all your kabuki theater claims. I'll follow up on them. I'll match them. I'll post the payments. I'll put the money in your bank. And I'll create a link to your old system so you can go back if you ever need to. So that gets us online. It gets all the patient records online, all the patient identities online. Now to step up and add patient communications, not that big a deal. It's almost the flipping of a switch. Just make sure that at reception you get their email address and their cell phone number. And then medical records comes after that.
So you started very incrementally with the claim. And even in the very earliest days, did you actually just take paper and plug it into a computer?
No. Luckily for us, in the 80s, the Bush 41 administration had made a rule that you get paid a dollar extra for every Medicare claim you send in electronically and a dollar less for every Medicare claim that you send in on paper. And the $2 spread created a giant market for electronic billing systems. And so almost every doctor that we showed up at since inception had some form of electronic billing system that we could put a needle in and kind of suck the patient data and insurance data out of. Now, it turned out the insurance data was so bad that we couldn't use it, but at least it gave us a starting point.
What companies do you look to outside of the healthcare industry that are analogous?
I think of it like an ages of man. So you have, you know, we're not an enterprise software company, which is sort of like primordial ooze in this day and age. Then there are SaaS companies which say, hey, I'll rent you my app. I'll host it. I'll back it up. And I'll rent you my app to go do your work. Then there are cloud-based services or network services which say the app isn't the product. It's the store you go into to get the product. So Amazon hires just as many programmers or more as Salesforce.com, right? Salesforce.com is a SaaS company. Amazon is a network service. They sell you stuff. The outcome is the stuff. And Athena is the same way. We're selling paid claims. Uber, right? You don't buy a license to Uber, but you click on the thing and there's a freaking car. It's pretty amazing.
So you're more like Uber and Amazon.
That's right.
Who else?
Airbnb sells butts in houses, right? Unless you're in the house, you don't pay.
Where are you hosting all of this data? Where are your warehouses of computers?
Right. In a series of undisclosed locations on different power grids around the country. That's something we do ourselves. But right now, with the level of security and privacy in healthcare, there's nobody who can do it at the standard we need to do it.
So when you're driving by on a highway in Oklahoma and you see this behemoth building, it could be one of your data warehouses,
That's
but it
right.
doesn't have a name on it.
That's right.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is John Bush, co-founder of Athena Health, a healthcare information technology company that facilitated the cloud-based model for the healthcare industry. So in other words, Athena Health makes healthcare data collection more efficient by managing electronic health records, facilitating financial transactions, and enhancing patient communication. The original company that you founded, Athena Health, looked a lot different from the company that it has become. It was focused on women's health, and it was a birthing practice, basically, in San Diego. What was the reason you started that?
Well, you can imagine the sort of super ego bake-off at the Bush family summer vacation. You know, dinner is a tough one. So you grew up with people who have done all kinds of extraordinary public service.
And we should say, I'm interrupting, that your uncle is George H.W. Bush. Your cousin is George W. Bush.
Grandfather was a senator. I mean, they're all over the place. Great-grandfather started a really big Wall Street house. Anyway, the point is that I wanted to do something, you know, very good, but also that would, you know, pay bills and let my kids go to fancy pants private schools, you know, the way I got to go. And so the first idea was maybe a doctor. It didn't seem like there were a lot of doctors in the Bush family. So I tried being a doctor by getting an EMT license and working for the city of New Orleans, driving an ambulance from 6 at night to 6 in the morning. It was the best job in the world.
And you were an EMT during college.
Yeah, that's right.
And you went from BU, you were a freshman, you transferred to Wesleyan where you ultimately graduated.
I did.
So yeah. You were an EMT for a summer. You trained as a medic during Operation Desert Storm.
Yep.
And so you were dabbling in the medical area.
I was trying to find a path that would work for my non-science But I sort of liked big patterns more than little patterns. So where the ambulances sat seemed to me to be a bigger way to save lives than what actually happened in the ambulance. Got more interested in those kinds of distribution problems, how much the ambulance knew when they got to the patient, how much the hospital knew when the ambulance got to the hospital. It was down to a bunch of slang codes that got rattled over the radio, and it didn't have to, it seemed to me.
But then why focus on birthing in San Diego?
So there I am. I thought maybe it would be ambulance. I'd start an ambulance company. And we would, instead of all these little city ambulances that were kind of disorganized and subscale, you could do super regional ambulances. And then American Medical Response went public. Somebody had already done it. And I was like, damn. So I looked for other things. My partner Todd was a guy I met at Booz Allen. And he and I started looking at places where you could build a retail brand where people would be able to choose the better product, but that was expensive enough that it used the sort of world of hospitals and specialists and surgeons And the perfect mix of those two was women's health, because women actually choose their OB, but they almost always end up in a hospital.
You have five children. Did you have any children at the time?
Yes, that's why I have so many children. I was recruiting OBs to our women's center. We had five kids with three different midwives at three different institutions.
They were midwives.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So was that one of the incentives for starting this birthing-oriented practice?
That's right.
Company?
The entire profit line of Athena Women's Health was focused on hospital days that didn't happen. NICU days, neonatal intensive care unit days that didn't happen because women made it to term, delivered naturally, didn't get as many interventions, didn't panic as much, and breastfed longer out the back. That was the basic play.
And was that your wife?
That was my wife. Five for five. Unbelievable natural birth athlete.
And how come, how far into it did you start to make the shift from this women's focus, which, by the way, Athena Health, I assume the name, Athena being the goddess of wisdom.
Who herself had a non-traditional birth. We did not recommend anyone else leap from their father's forehead.
So why then the shift from this women's practice
right.
to this software service company?
Right. Well, like many sort of Napoleonic young souls, we bit off more than we could chew. We were able to attract women to the model. We grew the practice 50%. We marketed. We attracted people. But we couldn't get the insurance company to pay the bonus. We couldn't prove that the surgery didn't happen and that this was the lower cost birth. We couldn't even get the basic claims paid. The amount of crap the doctors have to go through just to get baseline revenue is extraordinary. We didn't get it. But as we started drowning in it, we built a website. My partner Todd's younger brother, Eddie, came from Harvard, pushed through building a little website to keep track of our 13 little clinics in Southern California. And then little by little by little, we got to where we were barely figuring it out. And all the doctors in town wanted to use our website. None of them wanted us to replace them with midwives.
So what you're saying is that your partner's brother, Ed, built a system to manage your being paid by insurance companies. And it was out of this personal need that Athena Health became what it did today.
That's exactly right. It was just a total lucky thing that Eddie and Bob, our original CTO, happened to be in San Diego County, which happened to have, you know, storefront available DSL service first in the country. I mean, so many things just went right enough that we got the drop on this idea. We screen scraped the Medi-Cal website for eligibility information before that was illegal. You know, all kinds of stuff worked out. And then everyone said, geez, I'll have some of that.
Accidentally.
Absolutely.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jonathan Bush, co-founder of Athena Health. We'll hear more from Jonathan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is John Bush, co-founder of Athena Health, a cloud-based software-enabled healthcare company that helps manage patients' electronic medical records, enhance communication between patients and physicians, and facilitate payments to healthcare providers. John founded the company in 1997 with Todd Park, whom he worked with at Booz Allen Hamilton. You have kind of a performance nature to you. Your brother, incidentally, your younger brother, is Billy Bush, radio host, and there's
like Access Hollywood.
There's like jazz hands a little bit.
I am the son of a Broadway performer. My dad, Jonathan Bush, was Will Parker in Oklahoma. He was a baritone in the traveling Oldsmobile Show quartet.
You have landed in an unlikely place, and your father, too, landed in an unlikely place from being a dancer on Broadway to being a banker. He started his own firm, J. Bush and Company. Did you have aspirations, by the way, of being a performer professionally?
Yes, I did. I thought I acted in high school and tried to act in college, but I never got a part. And, you know, I had all kinds of fantasies about show business. But I think, like my father, maybe a little earlier, I realized that if I wanted to have a family and other things, I had to really be ready to make a real trade. Also, I watched Lenny McCormick perform in Spencer for Hire, and it was so many takes of the same little script. And it was so much about her tight, tight dress. And it wasn't what I thought. And so I was like, I'm going to perform differently. I'm going to perform. And today what I do is I employ 3,000 people to listen to my speeches, you know, once a quarter. And I give great stand-up when they're being paid to listen.
And so that's how you scratch the performance itch.
That's it.
Your dad was a banker after being a dancer. He sold his company in the same year that you started Athena Health. Was that coincidental, by the way?
Nope. He was gunning hard for me to take up the J. Bush & Company. I think you wouldn't even have to change the J. Bush. You could just step right in. But I just couldn't get to kind of making the world safe for the 1%. It just wasn't moving me, and I felt bad because I loved working with my dad, which I did for a year as I helped him sold the business. But he exited when I wasn't going to do it.
He helped you. He invested.
He angel investor, absolutely. There's a house up in Maine called the Temple of Athena that he built.
How much did he invest in the earliest days or ultimately?
First round was 150, and I think he came into the second round too, and I don't remember how much, but he also worked it. I mean, every college room, I mean, he hit the road getting people to meet with me.
And George H.W. Bush was also an early investor. So
yes.
Your family made investments but also made introductions for you.
Absolutely, yes.
What are some other examples of introductions?
Always raising the superego bar so that I had to be even more successful to justify the unfair, you know, leg up that I got. Think of the shame and the guilt. My whiteness goes on for years. We had George and Barbara Bush. We had my folks, my grandmother, every boss. I mean, I hit up everyone, college roommates of my father, everyone I could find. And then this one really successful healthcare entrepreneur who actually my dad and I were pitching to be a client of J. Bush & Company. He had just sold his home health business, Larry Soss now.
I appreciate your frankness about the being born on third base phenomenon.
Yes.
Why hide it?
It's there. I will say it's not all sunshine and candy, because there's a lot of guilt and shame. But I'm taking it and I'm using it.
And once these doors were opened, what is an example of a place that thought, oh, you know what? I took this meeting because he's a Bush, but you know what? There is something there. What's an example of that where you felt there was that authentic conversion?
I don't know. That's a good question. I thought you were going to ask a different question, which is, you know, being a Bush is a great advantage unless you happen to be in Massachusetts, where it often acts as a wind in your face. The majority of my employees are Democrats, et cetera. So there's always been a sort of overcoming angle to it.
But this is a different overcoming I'm asking about.
Yeah, overcoming the unfavorable starting point, I guess. Well, I think that's what's nice about building an arm's length service. People are doing it because the thing works.
But initially, you were doing it.
I'm dancing because I can't think of examples where it played well. I mean, it was a very liberal group of doctors and midwives in San Diego. I mean, high intensity of flip-flops and clogs on the floors. It was not a really big Bush place. I think really it was the fundraising. It was the kind of Wall Street-y oil and then this home health guy, that made it was appealing to take a look.
In 2007, you had an IPO, which was the most successful of the year. The price went up 97%.
Yeah, when you interview entrepreneurs, don't use Wall Street's definition of success, because that was a disaster for me, right? When the stock goes up, all that money of increase in stock price is money that you could have in your company's treasury if you had charged more for the IPO, right? So the bankers pushed us down on the price that we would issue. Oh, it won't work. You have to charge, you know, $18 a share or whatever. So we end up relenting after 11 days in an airplane. You know, I'm in the fetal position, having given this speech 100 times. I relent. They price the round at $18 a share. By noon that day, it's at 36.
But you held on to stock. So your stock went
up
with
that. Other than the fleecing that happened to the company, everybody wins. And that's why that's been allowed to continue. It's astonishing that we define a successful IPO as one where the company is actually left with less money than they would have had. But if you're the seller, you got beat.
Nevertheless, the perception was
momentum, you know, look at this, it's on the move, you know, so I agree.
Regardless of the chip on your shoulder towards the Wall Street bankers, the perception was one of success, which was the incentive for more customers and people jumping onto your wagon.
I will say, with my petty concerns aside, being public has been very good for Athena.
It was a marketing play as well as a financial
That's
one.
Right. That we're real. We're not disappearing. This idea of health care on the internet is not as much a fad as it would have been if it wasn't public.
You have sponsored hackathons related to Athena Health. Can you describe what that really means?
Sure. A hackathon is an open event, a fair for whipping together a crappy piece of software that solves a problem that no one's got a piece of software. It's like a rapid invention game. And as we started this interview, you pointed out that healthcare is a very sleepy place. There's very little in the way of entrepreneurship. In 2011, in a market where we spent $1.9 trillion, total venture capital into healthcare technologies of any kind was $895 million. Less than $1 billion. Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. So the reason that people are getting onto shitty systems and the reason that people aren't shopping and the reason that there is a federal website and that it doesn't work is that there is no layer of connected entrepreneurial technological energy. There's no code base to work from. And so we've actually started a thing called More Disruption Please, MDP. And we invite companies. We've got 450 companies that have signed up. And then we attract developers to form companies. And then we say, hey, we'll build an API. You can use our security layer, our privacy layer, and we'll sell your stuff to our clients. Because I'd rather have competition but have something happening than just be kind of this isolated vacuum of lameness.
So what's an example of somebody or a company that came to you through your hackathon that's now part of Athena Health?
The name that's popping into my head is this group called Entrada that has built a cloud-based voice recognition app that's targeted, specifically educated around medical terminology. So no matter what machine you may log into, it knows that it's you, and it takes all the learning it's done on your voice to better recognize medical terms. So we don't have that. It might be on our list somewhere, but we ain't getting to it in the next 5 years. These guys are ready. So now doctors can turn on Entrada inside of their Athena medical record. Mm. There's a couple apps that allow scheduling. So there are all these companies that offer, that kind of crawl the web saying, hey, do you need a doctor? You know, here's one who's close to you. Here's one who's a woman. Here's one who's does organic stuff. And you can click. And if it's an Athena doctor, you can actually make the appointment there online.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is John Bush, co-founder of Athena Health, a company that electronically provides healthcare services. Athena Health has been growing at 30% since you started. What does that mean?
Well, Athena Health has been growing by over 30% a year every year since we went public. And the idea is to keep knocking out 30% more even from a larger base so that in a few years, it just doesn't make any sense not to be on a national network. You know, it would be unsafe for a mom to bring a baby, start the pediatric record with an unconnected doctor. Even if you love them, it's like, are you on AthenaNet? You know, just remember when you slowed down at the cash machine banks to see if your logo is on the glass window so you could know whether your card would work, like is it Cirrus or Nice? I'd like to see in a couple of years patients slowing down to see that olive branch saying, are you on AthenaNet or not? And if you're not, is Athena connected to my logo, whatever the other one will be.
And you're not even checking when you go to the ATM anymore, right? To the
today,
bank anymore.
They're all connected, right? So as other clouds emerge doing what we do, which I guess I hope happens, there's a dark side of me that wants them all to fail, but those few national networks should easily build interchange agreements and say, hey, if it's our patient going to you, I want $5. And if it's your patient coming to me, I'll pay $5 or whatever.
And you see that marketplace evolving eventually.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it. This has all been done. We have interchange fees for bank machines. We stumble drunk into any cash machine in the world. And the exchange rate and the bank-to-bank transaction and the balance checking, it's all done. We take for granted. We're like, $3, that's awful. No, that's a freaking miracle, right? It's all happening so we can watch it. All we got to do is do a pretty okay copy. And we can blow away the stuff we hate about healthcare with it.
You are a runner. You've run, how many marathons have you run?
Just the one.
And why do you call it the one?
I was divorced and I was being encouraged to be visible and date and be less fat, frankly. And drink less and smoke less and many of the things that I did to cope with divorce, less. And so a dear friend who worked at GBH said, I'm going to get you on a reality show, WGBH.
In
a public television, public radio did a Nova show on sort of misfits running the marathon, and I got to be one of the misfits, got a free number, and it was a really important life event for me.
You are remarried now.
I am, yes.
And you live in Cambridge, and your five children also live in Cambridge with
yep.
your former...
We go back and forth.
With your ex-wife.
Yeah. Yep.
What is the experience of your children having watched you, you know, build this company basically since they were born?
It's a really good question. I think that starting a business, especially one that works, ironically, can be really bad for a marriage. You feel... in those early days, like you are the Dutch boy with his finger in the dike. You are, you know, got a little bit of a messiah thing. Like, I've got to hold this on, you know, even if it kills me. I slept for years with a beeper, pre-cell phone era beeper, strapped to my boxer shorts so that it would vibrate so I wouldn't wake up my wife. But the very idea that I went to bed with literally Athena sort of on my loins... you know, really contributed to the divorce. I mean, it really...
And this is perhaps, you know, this is a harbinger of the iPhones that are on the pillows of people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I now, you know, one marriage later, leave my iPhone in the kitchen when I go upstairs. But that idea of that hypervigilance, you know, I know that it had to be hard and I know I had to bleed hard for this to work. I didn't need that level of hypervigilance. And my children, you know, A, experienced the divorce, which ain't a lot of fun, and I think also probably experienced, you know, why isn't he looking at me, you know, why isn't he here? I mean, I was able to attend a lot of stuff, but were my eyes and brain, was I present? And that idea of all that time probably being more hypervigilant than I had to be, it, you know, took a toll on them.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is John Bush, co-founder of Athena Health, a company that electronically provides healthcare services. When you applied to Harvard Business School, what was your essay about?
Great. It's a great question. I will be the best healthcare services entrepreneur that you have. I'm going to do this. I'm going to build a service that improves the quality of healthcare, and I'm going to make it into a business.
So you knew going into business school that you wanted to start in this area.
Going specifically to write the business plan. Todd Park was my buddy at Booz Allen. He stayed at Booz Allen, didn't go to business school. But he and I agreed that I would do this, get the airtime, get the call back. You know, it's easy to get someone to call you back when you're calling from Harvard Business School, right? So I would do that angle. I would get the business plan vetted in that environment. And every class I took at HBS, in my mind, was the marketing angle, the staffing angle, the governance angle, the finance angle of my women's health business, of our women's health, Todd's and my women's health business. And we entered the business plan contest with our business plan and weren't a finalist, which is quite a wake-up call.
Tell me about your relationship with Todd, your co-founder.
Todd Park is the most prolific doer of good work I have ever met in my life.
What do you mean?
He has the ability to stay focused on a problem effectively, creatively, intensively, analytically, for periods of time that just don't make any sense to me. He just can stay on it for too long. When we were at Booz Allen, he could work for 2 or 3 days straight. And that's how we really met, was sort of, I was the guy of our duo in charge of saying, you know, you can expense the limo service if you're here after 8, you know. And he'd be sitting there alone at 11 p.m. waiting for the M18 bus, you know, to go across town to his apartment that he was never in. And, you know, there's a laundry service, they have it at the office, where he was buying underpants at the store rather than wash the ones he had.
Because he was at the office so long.
Because he was so intense on the problem. And so I provided this air cover for him. But he provided an intensity of follow-through that I and vision, but really the follow-through was the one thing that was shocking. And so we went out as a duo like that.
And so he was the steady heart of this, and you were the, what would you say, your...
I think my primary role in the early days was the jealous protector of Todd in some way. And I think also maybe the jealous, like because of my ability to give up before he, I was able to declare things that weren't working, not working in time before they killed us, just barely. I'm not a big giver-upper either, but compared to Todd, I'm a total... wuss.
A more positive slant would be when this birthing idea wasn't as lucrative as you had thought, you pivoted the company with Todd.
I think I was the one who did that, yeah.
And not just focusing on women's health anymore, obviously.
That's right. So in order to do that much narrower service, we needed a much broader audience.
And you do personally have breadth. You dabbled Dabble perhaps is too light of a word, but you experienced being an EMT for a little while. You experienced being trained as a medic.
Captain's license when I was 16. I mean, I go through ways of being, you know. I'm a child of Manhattan, right? You could jump on the subway and pop up somewhere where everybody's only speaking Spanish and then pop down and pop up again and everyone's only speaking Russian. And that's a gift to start with that. And it allows me to kind of connect a lot of different disciplines at work. And connect to a lot of different audiences as well.
Now, while there is a positive spin or view of having breadth as a person these days, how was it perceived when you were growing up in Manhattan, in your family?
Well, I grew up in a cocoon where, you know, the four people who thought that way all lived, and they didn't know there were any other people. Everybody else was sort of a prop, like the painted scene going by in Captain Kangaroo.
Because you and your brother and your father and your mother, I guess you said four, were of that nature.
That's right. I mean, my dad was a song and dance man on Wall Street.
And how about your mother?
My mother was the same way. She was the son of a Navy commander in the Second World War, and then she was at the Museum of Modern Art, and then she was at the Inwood House Home for Unwed Mothers, and she was and then she was suddenly raising money for presidential campaigns that she had no experience in whatsoever. She's one minute her friend Frankie Tang and she are going to open a Chinese restaurant, and we all of a sudden have 50-pound bags of rice and dried ducks in apartment 14A. I remember when I was in first grade, I came in and we walk in the door, and there's five Cambodian people in the house boiling things. And what's going on? They're living with us. This is the Minister of Culture from Cambodia, and he was going to be killed in the Pol Pot. And so we agreed at a dinner party to have him live with us. And it turns out when he showed up from the refugee camp, he had his wife and two kids and his wife's sister. And there we all were on the 14th floor of his apartment on 86th Street, shacking up, you know. And that was the kind of thing that I think helped a lot. We were shacked up in San Diego. Everybody at Athena Health lived on the floor of the world headquarters when we got started.
So from Chinese restaurants to Athena Health, thank you very much for joining us.
It was a real privilege. I love your show.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest has been Jonathan Bush, co-founder of Athena Health. Coming up, we'll meet Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment, including iPhones, Blackberries, iPads, and recent Apple computers, among other items. The company was launched in 2006 and has recycled more than 1 million devices since inception. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
Could you please describe how Gazelle works? Let's say I have a BlackBerry Curve that I want to get off my hands.
What you'll do is go to our website, either on the desktop or on your mobile device, and look up the specific model that you want to sell. You'll answer a couple of simple questions about the condition of the item, and you get a price. And if you like the price, you'll give us your shipping address so we can send you packaging, and we'll pay for the shipping. As soon as you put the item in the mailbox and ship it to us, we'll receive it, inspect it, make sure that it's as described by you, and then send you the payment.
Now, you're a consumer-facing business, but it hasn't always worked this way. You initially tried partnering with businesses when you first launched. Can you describe that experience and some examples of that?
We've gone through quite an evolution. So in the early days, what we wanted to do is access consumers that buy product, and what a better place than go to Best Buy, go to Radio Shack, go to Amazon, eBay, where consumers buy new product, and help those companies, those retailers, offer a trading service to their customer base. It just made a lot of sense. What the struggle was back then was that the economy was flourishing, the whole sustainability movement was just getting started, and frankly, this was not top on anybody's list.
And was there a catalyst or a specific event that really gave you the engine and the motivation to say, okay, we're going to change direction?
Yes, it's quite memorable. So we spent a lot of time with Best Buy. In April of 2007, we got a call in the evening basically saying that while they appreciate all the work that we put into developing the program with them, they were going to pass. We were running out of cash. And again, we either had to close shop or change direction in a very aggressive way.
You also changed course at an auspicious moment. The economy was collapsing, which ironically was beneficial for the company. How come?
It was very beneficial to Gazelle because the biggest opportunity was to build awareness that all the stuff that's in your drawers, in your closets, that you know, the 5-year-old BlackBerry, the 3-year-old laptop that you're not using anymore has a value. It's collecting dust. So in the early days, it was really all about cash for your gadgets that you're not using, as opposed to where it is today, much more on upgrading.
The number of devices that you accept is roughly less than 500. But back then, it was over, what, 200,000?
Hundreds of thousands, including movies and games and GPS systems. Was everything under the sun except for TVs.
And what percent of these devices do you actually, are you able to resell versus that you're stuck with?
Everything has value. The only question is how much. From day one, everything that we acquired and paid value for, we are able to turn around and sell at the profit. So currently we resell 100% of the product, or if it's not 100%, it's 98%, 99%. The interesting thing about this business, which has always fascinated me, is that it's a supply-constrained business. Demand is insatiable.
You have spoken about the car trade-in business as an analogy to what you're doing. What parallels or similarities do you see, and what would you like to replicate?
Sure. So in the car business, 40 to 50% of all new car sales have a trade-in involved in it. So it's so consumer behavior around trade-in, to your point, is inherent in the way we buy new cars. That figure for consumer electronics is about 3%. Inertia is a very strong kind of human behavior, consumer behavior. When you buy the new, let's say, iPhone, you don't care a whole lot about the old device. It's sort of your ex at the time. So building awareness for the value of the devices and then convincing consumers that there is a service out there in Gazelle that provides a much easier, much more convenient, much faster, much safer way to get that value for your device is a challenge, a marketing challenge for us.
So when you buy these devices, whom are you selling the used devices to?
I would say it falls into three different categories. The biggest market is in the emerging countries, Southeast Asia. It goes into the Philippines, into Malaysia. The Middle East is a big market, Nigeria. A second category of buyers are insurance companies. When you lose your phone, you drop it in the water, well, you're not getting a new one. The third would be consumers that don't get the warranty or consumers that want to buy a used laptop, a used iPad for their kids maybe.
They'll go to
eBay, they'll go to Amazon, they'll go to our store. Mm-hmm. On those marketplaces and buy directly from us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Personal circumstances caused you to move back to Boston in 2006. You at the time had been living in the San Francisco area, but your wife wanted to move back to her hometown in Boston. Can you describe that moment?
It was obviously a very important moment in our relationship, and we had an 18-month-old, we had an 8-week-old, two girls, and you know, both I and my wife, both of us grew up with lots of family around us, and my family was in Israel at the time, and we tried once to fly to Israel from the Bay Area, and it was a complete disaster with the baby crying for 10 straight hours on the flight, and it was time to pack up, move to Boston, and be close to family. Hmm. And figure out the career stuff later.
Right. You mentioned that your family was in Israel. You actually were born in Peru and spent the first 5 or 6 months of your life in Peru. What brought your parents to Peru initially?
So my dad spent 25 years with the Israeli army. He specialized in training of tanks. I guess at the time, in 1970, the Israeli army was in the process of selling tanks to the Peruvian army. I was born there. And they spent about a year there before moving back to Israel.
Were your parents in Israel when the country was founded after World War II?
Both of them were. My dad was born in Bulgaria, so he moved to Israel 3 years before the country was founded. My mom actually was born in Jerusalem under the British mandate.
you spent the first 18 years of your life roughly in Israel. What was the reason for moving to the United States?
Yes, so my my parents in the late 80s, it was actually pretty tough times in Israel in terms of a very prolonged recession. Nobody in my family has ever been to college at the time, and they just felt that education and just giving us an opportunity was their life mission. And I guess they said it's now or never, and just got on the plane and moved here with absolutely no prospects for a job.
So you get off the plane, and what next?
What next? So first, you're intimidated by moving to New York. It was really scary, actually, in the early days. My father scrambling to find a job, my mom looking for a job, I was looking for a job, and it was really all about survival.
What were some of the early jobs you got?
It was for a video store. It was 77th Street and Lexington Avenue, okay. Video Vogue, no longer there. And they were selling consumer electronics in the front. I grew up just loving watching movies. So the idea of working at a store, even was it $4 an hour, bringing movies home and watching them for free, was very appealing to me. I started working there and really didn't have a plan for where to take it.
What else about, just in addition to building a work ethic and having to scramble, how else did working in the video store influence
right.
you? I mean, there were electronics in the front of the store. Was there any resonance there?
Well, basically, the purpose of the store was to serve the clientele of the Upper East Side and provide the highest possible customer service known to mankind.
Okay.
So some of the customers were Woody Allen, Robin Williams, Ron Perlman, and they were just very demanding customers. So it was all about doing whatever it takes. But frankly, for me, it was a shock to the system. My first images were not kind of happy memories of watching movies. Was my first winter in New York, delivering movies on my feet while it was snowing and blizzards on the streets, going 10, 20 blocks on Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, delivering movies to those glamorous apartments, mansions in Manhattan, and my jaw was dropping every time I was dropping off a movie in some of those places. That was cleaning the toilet, frankly, and cleaning the shelves and making sure the store looked good and that it was welcoming to our customers. Those were their early days at Video Vogue.
So moving from Video Vogue to NYU, where you finally went to college and got a degree, what were your ambitions professionally? Were you just trying to make ends meet, or did you have some longer-term plan?
So living in New York, it was kind of natural to gravitate to the finance world. I don't remember the name of the book, but I remember a book that was written about the life of Ron Perlman. It was coincidentally a weekend day that he stopped by.
Ron Perlman being the
Revlon guy, the corporate raider of the 1980s. Which started to get me thinking about Wall Street. The movie Wall Street obviously came out in 1987. And I feel that that's something that I could actually pursue.
What were your parents doing, incidentally? What kind of jobs did they hold?
So my dad was a limo driver, a car service driver. And my mom worked at one of the Israeli newspapers.
After you graduated from NYU, your first job outside of college was at Harvard Business School writing cases for them. And one of the cases you happened to help write was about Microsoft, where you went out to Seattle and you wrote about Bill Gates. Can you describe any interesting tidbits from that experience?
Yeah, that experience clearly planted a seed in me about the future of technology. And one of the things that Bill Gates said at the office, we spent about 3 hours with him. One thing that he said that I'll never forget was that Israel, one of the best ways to change the world is through technology, which has become evident over the years, obviously, with the companies like Microsoft and others. But for me personally, coming from my business background, my finance background, I frankly didn't know who Bill Gates was. I was barely using email at the time, let alone Windows. So that was a whole new world to me. Now, at the time, I didn't know what to do with it. Other than the fact that it was intriguing and interesting, I still had that Wall Street bug in me, so I had to go back and get it out of my system.
So you ultimately went to Goldman Sachs and graduated from HBS and got the Wall Street bug out of you. And then you begin a whole new chapter professionally, which is really in startups and e-commerce. even though you were an employee at these companies, you still had this entrepreneurial itch because in 1997, actually while you were still at Goldman Sachs, you co-authored a business plan for a startup called Cosmo.com, which at the time was an internet-based video rental business,
right,
which at one point had a $1 billion valuation in 99.
Yes, they actually filed the S-1 in March of 2000, and they were ready to go public.
How did mm-hmm. you come to be on the founding team of Cosmo?
So one of my cubemates at Goldman was the co-founder of Cosmo, and he came up with the notion of the idea behind Cosmo right after the Amazon IPO. He approached me because he knew about my experience working at Video Vogue. And we worked together for about 6 months, nights and weekends, developing the business plan, coming up with the name. And at the end of the day, he decided to leave Goldman and pursue it full time and build Cosmo. I decided to go back to business school.
Were there any impressions from that experience that you've carried with you?
That the world was going to change. It was pretty clear that the world was about to change and the internet was going to revolutionize everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. What were some important impressions from eBay or your PayPal experience that have carried over to Gazelle?
What was amazing about that time is to spend 2 years with entrepreneurs in those markets, building their companies from scratch, learning about their challenges of building a business, how they think about an exit strategy, whether eBay was going to buy them, an IPO, a different kind of partnership. So I just soaked up all that knowledge. That was really helpful for me to get a glimpse of what it's like to be an entrepreneur in all those different markets.
I want to go back to the early days of Gazelle for a moment. I want to talk about venture capital. In 2008, even though you had this auspicious moment where the economy was collapsing and people wanted to, you know, resell their items, the economy was collapsing. So their, you know, venture capitalists did not have their checkbooks open. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, first thing I'll say, it was never easy to raise capital in my experience at Gazelle. But the context of when you raise money obviously is critical. And you're raising a good point. So in late 2008, we were raising our second round of capital. So the first round was completed in 2007. Venrock, who incidentally was one of the early investors in Apple, was the lead investor of the Series A. Now, in November of 2008, we were ready to close the B round with Rockport Capital. And I'll never forget the day when we were going to close the deal. That was one of the days that the Dow was fell 1,000 points. And I was really nervous about, is this deal going to close? And I remember at the time, even the Rockport guys, I mean, they still wanted to pursue it, but everybody was getting cold feet. That was the week after the, I don't know if you remember, the Sequoia presentation came out about how the world was going to come to an end and investments were going to shut down and companies had to scale back their growth ambitions. And here we are, pitching a story about growth and about how this is the, you know, the recession and this dynamics in the market was one of the best things that ever happened to Gazelle. So it helped us push the deal through and get it done. But was it easy? Absolutely not.
You co-founded Gazelle with Russo Aurelien and James Michelini. Even before you came on board, Russo and James were seriously flirting with this concept, and they had borrowed $60,000 to buy used equipment that they then repurposed and sold on eBay for $500,000. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so that was fascinating for me when I met with Russo, and he was telling me that story in terms of the success they were having, and his point was, everything sells. Everything sells at good profit. The only challenge that we have is getting more equipment. And that was kind of the foundation for the idea for Gazelle and Recommerce. At the time, the whole consumer electronics business on eBay was a $14 billion business. There was just a lot of demand.
So it was Russo who had the initial idea for this Recommerce recycling business.
Yeah, what I love the most about Russo is such an amazing guy. He's the true visionary guy. I'm more the guy with 2 feet on the ground, getting stuff done. He was really the visionary guy. What really sold me on joining him and James was his grand vision. And his grand vision was to introduce the concept of trade-ins into other consumer categories, starting with electronics, but also sporting goods, golf clubs, fashion items, IT equipment, servers, etc. So the vision was big. Now, pretty quickly after joining the team and we started actually thinking about developing a plan, we had to start somewhere in a narrow focus.
Now, Rousseau is from Haiti.
Yes. And we kind of went together through the earthquake in Haiti, where his parents' house was completely demolished by the earthquake, and they moved to the U.S. and kind of seeing him going through that period, you know, tough period in his life, his family's life was interesting and, you know, something I could definitely empathize with.
Simultaneously, while Rousseau and James were pursuing this concept on the East Coast, while you were still back west, you wanted to recycle your own mobile equipment. What was that story?
The story was before I was moved back here, it's before I knew about Rousseau, I went down to a retail store and tried to recycle a couple of BlackBerry phones. And I go in and I ask the guy how much for these phones. And the guy goes, $20. Said, $20, I can sell them on eBay for $75. And he goes, no, actually, we're going to charge you $20 for the privilege of recycling. And that was when I had this big aha moment. The consumers are not going to pay for the privilege of recycling. And that's how, you know, the idea of re-commerce kind of started to germinate in my head.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
My guest has been Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.